This is Jim Engster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is our producer, and signature support is from Jerry Lane Chevrolet and First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. We start with investigative reporter Andrea Gallo of The Advocate, and she has covered many stories over the last several years that have been searing and in some cases disturbing, and one of the latest is regarding some problems with Louisiana's child welfare. And the headline in the Sunday Advocate, huge caseloads, high stakes, Louisiana's child welfare workers reeling from dire staffing and from job trauma. Now, this investigation was spurred by the death of a young person who died of a fentanyl overdose, something that was known as far as the misdeeds by those caring for the young person. And nonetheless, the kid died, and now people are looking to see if other children are in danger. And there are some holes in the offensive line, as they say. But the people at Child and Family Services indicate that they're doing their best to correct the wrongs, and it is a tough job. It's tough in every state, but in Louisiana, the numbers show that we have cause for concern. How much cause, based on your research, Andrea Gallo?
Thanks for having me, Jim. I think it's huge cause for concern. Workers are extremely overburdened. The Department of Children and Family Services has 460 vacancies right now, and that means that when children are in vulnerable positions, whenever there are reports of abuse and neglect, there just aren't enough workers and there aren't enough hours in the day to respond to all of those reports and to, you know, make sure that these children are safe.
Well, you noted in your story that caseloads vary by region, but several caseworkers said they average between 25 and 30 cases a month. And the state reports it averaged 87 completed reports per worker in 2020. The national average was 67, so that's a 30% increase in Louisiana. And as I mentioned, much of this attention, it evolved after the death of Mitchell Robinson. Can you tell us the background on that story?
Sure. This was a story that really came to light in August. So this little boy, Mitchell Robinson, who was 2 years old, he had been hospitalized a few times. And the first time he was hospitalized, there was some suspicion about what had really led to his problems. And fentanyl isn't a drug that normally shows up on like hospital tox screens. It's something that requires specialized testing, and those sorts of tests can usually take a while to come back. So he's hospitalized the first time. There's a warning to DCFS that he had to be revived with Narcan, which is the kind of anti-overdose drug. And then DCFS doesn't really do anything with it. They close the report. They don't investigate it. He's hospitalized a second time. There's a second report. And then the doctor calls in a third report and explains to the department, you know, here's what this means. And the second time they run the tox screen that shows he's positive for fentanyl. So DCFS gets that report. The worker tries to make contact with the family. The family's not there. Then the worker ends up going on sick leave, and the case kind of falls through the cracks. And maybe about a little over a week after the third report on him, the child overdosed on fentanyl and died.
And it's a terrible tragedy, and one that might very well have been averted, but it brought a lot of other concerns to light. Now, in 2019, based on your report, 8% of the openings for investigators were available. Today, 25%, even though the salary has gone up about $8,000 for an average investigator, $41,000 to about $49,000. Is this COVID-related, or is it more complex than that?
I certainly think it's partially COVID-related, and that's what the department has testified about quite a bit. They've talked about how, you know, everywhere is short on staffing right now, but there's a difference between being short on staffing at a restaurant where maybe your meal just takes a little longer to come out versus being short on staffing in a case involving life or death for a vulnerable child. So some of it is definitely COVID driven, but I've interviewed probably about a dozen workers across DCFS regions, and they say it's more than that. They say that there's a morale problem within the department, that there's toxic management and bad supervisors, and that's what's driving them away.
I mentioned to Andrea that I'm around long enough that I remember a case in 1985, the guy who managed the downtown Firestone at that time, Jack Lucky Obney, went to jail for second-degree murder for killing his girlfriend's three-year-old child, Joshua Nagy. And at that time, it was a case in which heads rolled. People were fired. I don't know that even though the case we referenced involving the fentanyl death, I don't know that there have been a lot of firings resulting from that. Does that in any way surprise you?
Well, in that case, the department announced afterward that they were going to open an investigation, like an internal investigation, and the state's Office of Inspector General also opened an investigation. So the Inspector General investigation is still happening. I assume the DCFS investigation is still happening, but the latest we heard on that was that the supervisor involved in the Mitchell Robinson case had resigned, and the worker had been placed on administrative leave pending the outcome. So as far as we know, there have not been any firings related to that case.
Now, we hear stories that this dearth of investigators is not a Louisiana unique situation, that it's happening around the country. And of course, COVID has affected every state. And sometimes people who are investigators get it and they can't be out and about doing their thing when they have COVID. But based on your findings, is it more severe in Louisiana, or is it something that is about the same as far as other states also having some of the same issues?
Other states are definitely struggling with this as well. When you look at news coverage in other states, they're also having similar problems with shortages of caseworkers and high caseloads. But there are certain factors that are unique to Louisiana that make this problem particularly dangerous and acute here. In our first story about this topic, we reported that Louisiana leads the nation in homicide rates of youth, and children in Louisiana are much more likely to be killed than children in other states. So whenever you combine those two factors, and along with the poverty levels here, it makes it especially dangerous for Louisiana to be so short on caseworkers.
Louisiana leads the overall homicide rate in the country, unfortunately, as well, for 33 consecutive years now. So I guess it would make sense, unfortunately, if we also led in homicides for young people. But are these cases in which guns are involved? What's the usual way in which these kids die? Or is it drugs? Right now, as we know, there are more people dying of opioid deaths in Baton Rouge than there are murders, and yet we hear much more about homicides.
It depends on the case. From what we know, children 3 and under are kind of the most likely to potentially be killed by parents or caretakers, and a lot of that is just based on their young age and vulnerability. So the department, in the wake of the Mitchell Robinson case, actually instituted a new policy where if a medical report comes in on a child under 3, they are supposed to automatically accept that as a first priority case, because, you know, the thinking is that if a doctor is reporting this, then it's probably serious and needs to be looked at. But once again, that just adds to the strain and the burden on caseworkers who are already backed up.
And you say the staffing is down 30% from its previous high, correct?
Right, from about 2007.
Wow. And that's 15 years earlier, and usually agencies over time have more workers rather than fewer. And in this case, this particular agency, which is extremely important, has 15% or 30% fewer workers. Now, you talked with people all over the state, didn't you?
Yes.
This was an extensive, exhaustive research situation for Andrea Gallo. Was it a consistent message sent throughout the state? or were some areas more pronounced in their challenges than others?
No, it's consistent, the messages that we're hearing, and that's kind of interesting because we're talking to workers who are in urban areas like New Orleans and Baton Rouge, and workers who are in much more rural areas like Avoyelles Parish, and they're all telling similar stories about being overworked, overburdened, exhausted, and feeling unsupported by management and by leadership.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. I have a few more minutes with Andrea Gallo, the investigative reporter for The Advocate. Her front page story in Sunday's paper, huge caseloads, high stakes, severe chronic staffing shortages are engulfing the Child Welfare Agency and leaving the state's most vulnerable children in peril. We'll talk more after this 90-second pause on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Andrea Gallo, investigative reporter for The Advocate, is with us for a few more minutes. Her book, her story in The Advocate, which could be a book, Exhaustive Research, Suffering So Young, Louisiana's Child Welfare Crisis. And this is something that is happening around the country for various reasons. And staffing is hard. And as we know, many factors of our society right now, any facets of our society. And so this would, it would seem obvious that a tough job like this, high stress, and plus you're going to see people and you don't know whether they have COVID. There's some safety issues. I can understand that some people might not want to do this for $48,000, $49,000 a year, Andrea.
Definitely. And these workers often have to work overnight, kind of on-call shifts, as they call them. So they might work all night long. They might be taking children out of dangerous households, sleeping in the office with them, as we reported on. And for all of that, they don't get paid overtime. They don't really get any sort of extra perks or anything like that. They're accumulating paid time off that most of them say they don't really have the time to even take.
Okay. Forgive me if I mispronounce your name, but I think it's Bagayoko in North Baton Rouge. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Correct. That is correct.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm trying to figure out, is it possible to blame the legislature or the office of the governor for not providing enough personnel for such a critical agency? I'm just wondering.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yes, I think so. That's what we're hearing from a lot of the stakeholders involved in this, a lot of the juvenile court judges who see this up close. It's the legislature and it's the governor's office that's responsible for funding this agency. And it's the legislature and the governor's office who have consistently underfunded them for over a decade at this point. So I definitely think that some of the blame lies there. And whenever the legislature holds hearings, which they're doing right now on DCFS and trying to probe a lot of these issues, that's what a lot of it comes back to, that DCFS does not have the resources to do these jobs effectively.
877-217-5757. Still time to talk with Andrea Gallo. Dustin at LSU. Dustin, good morning.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a researcher. I'm a graduate student at LSU, and I did a little bit of research for the DCFS. Basically found that some parenting program they had didn't have any effect on, you know, the likelihood of reoffense. I was wondering, we know, Andrew, you touched on poverty being such an issue in the state, and it seems that that is like one of the biggest issues. Why, I'm wondering what the state, can they see that, or what is the state trying to do to like raise people's standards of living if that's a main driver of why we see so much of these bad effects for children?
Yeah, that's a great question. So DCFS, as you probably know since you've studied them, also they do child welfare, but the kind of other half of their work is doing providing for families in need, doing food stamps and that sort of thing. And that's another area where they're understaffed. So you know, not only do they not have enough workers to check on reports of child abuse and neglect, they also don't have enough workers to help out with food stamps and social support and that sort of thing. I'm not saying that's entirely the reason why we consistently have high poverty in the state, but there are some interesting studies about how money that went toward families during COVID helped reduce poverty and helped reduce reports of child abuse in other parts of the country.
Stuart downtown, please be brief. You'll be our final caller for Andrea today. Stuart, you're on. Good morning, sir.
Thank you, Jim, Andrea, audience. Good morning. Andrea, your opinion, since you researched this, so do you think that we should, I'm a proponent of, if one gets on the system, if you're poor, if you're undereducated, et cetera, that after your first child, you should be made to be temporarily infertile, male or female?
All right. Don't think that's going to happen, Stuart, but there have been people on the right side and the left side of the political spectrum who have said this a time or two, including David Duke. I remember he wanted women to be Norplant to be put in their arms. But anyway, I don't think that's going to happen. But Andrea, if you want to expand upon it, go ahead.
No, that's okay, Jim. I'll let you take that one.
Okay. All right. Well, Andrea Gallo is a great reporter. We're privileged to have her here in Baton Rouge. 8 years now with The Advocate, graduate of LSU. She was editor of The Reveille and had the brass in her day to sue LSU when she was editor of The Reveille. I loved it. What was that suit about?
Public records.
Imagine that.
It was the LSU presidential search for that resulted in F. King Alexander.
And you ultimately won. So she's still doing her thing and doing it well. Appreciate you. Keep going.
Thanks, Jim.
We're joined now by Stephen V. Roberts, one of the great journalists in America. He's been doing his thing for half a century, a little more than that, actually. And, of course, he was married to one of the great reporters of her time or any time, our own Cokie Roberts. Stephen, who worked 25 years with the New York Times and still writes a syndicated column that appears in many newspapers, including The Advocate. He will be the keynoter at the Founders Day Luncheon for WRKF on Friday. If you'd like more information about that event, there are still some seats available, WRKF.org. And good morning to you, Stephen V. Roberts.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Nice to talk with you. And shall we say these are interesting times?
You know, many people ask me what Cokie would think about the current political environment. And, you know, it's interesting because when she was growing up here in Washington and in New Orleans, it was a very different time in many ways. But one of the key differences was that many of the families, like the Boggs family, and of course, as many of your listeners know, her father, Hale Boggs, and her mother, Lindy Boggs, served the 2nd District of New Orleans for a combined total of almost 50 years. We joke that we don't believe in term limits in our family. When they moved to Washington in this neighborhood where I still live, Jim, their next door neighbors were Republicans. And there were these, and many of her classmates at the local Catholic school she and her sister went to were children of Republican members of Congress. And there were all of these relationships across party lines, whether they were in neighborhoods or people sitting in church together or their kids in the same schools or playing on the same soccer teams. And a lot of that is gone. There are many, many reasons for the hostility and polarization in politics today. But that's one of them. And this absence of these personal relationships that Cokie always grew up with, and she was always very explicit and felt strongly that that was one of the reasons that things had changed. You know, when Betty Ford, a Republican, was planning her own funeral, she summoned Cokie and said, "I want you to speak at my funeral. I mean, give a eulogy at my funeral about the relationships between our families, the Republican Fords and the Democratic Boxes, and what that reflected about politics in that era." And that's a good example of something that's missing in Washington, and what mm-hmm. I think if Cokie were here should very much be lamenting.
Yeah, times have changed, and it's easy to blame it on Donald Trump, and Trump is certainly partly responsible, but did he cause this, or was he just a vessel of what was inevitable?
Well, I think a lot of it started long before Donald Trump. I think the person who, long before Donald Trump, who had the most to do with this was Newt Gingrich, who led Republicans to the majority in the House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years when they took over the House in 1994. And he was the one who ran against Washington as Gomorrah on the Potomac. He was the one who told his members, don't move your families there because you're going to be corrupted by Washington.
877-217-5757. We do have to take a break, but we will return with the incomparable Stephen V. Roberts, keynoter at the Founders Day Luncheon, back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Stephen V. Roberts, who's written about American politics since the 60s. He is in the House with us for a few minutes, and if you'd like to get in, 877-217-5757, the widower of Cokie Roberts. Stephen, through the years, got to know Louisiana rather well. Cokie and her mother, Lindy, and father, Hale, were icons in Louisiana. Grew up in New Orleans, did Cokie, and I remember Buddy Romer commented that Lindy lived on Bourbon Street at one time, down the street not so far from his grandfather, who was the Romer of the Walker Romer Dairy. And Stephen, even though you're from the East Coast, from New Jersey, and went to Harvard, I think you, by all rights, could be called an adopted Louisianian.
Well, I certainly hope so. Cokie transmitted such affection and respect for the state, and we visited there often, and of course she went down there all the time to see her mother. And you're right, Lindy had inherited a house on Bourbon Street from an aunt, Frosty Blackshear, and it was right there in the middle of Bourbon Street. And Cokie used to say, you know, he used to take our children, Lindy's grandchildren, over the woods and through the, over the hills and through the woods to grandmother's house we go, past the hookers and the strippers on Bourbon Street. It was not your typical, but, you know, when Lindy was, of course, named ambassador to the Vatican, and she was she already served 18 years in Congress. She was 80 years old. She was a little nervous about going. And Cokie said, Mama, this is a no-brainer. If you go to the Vatican, the costume, and you leave Bourbon Street, and you go to the Vatican, the costumes will be the same, dyes and dresses. But she also said, Mama, you get to do the two things in the world you love to do best, go to parties and go to church. So it was a perfect fit for Lindy to go from Bourbon Street to the Vatican. And we always loved visiting Lindy down there. And of course, she was, as many people know, her maiden name was Claiborne. It was Cokie's middle name. And they were direct descendants of W.C.C. Claiborne, who was the first governor of Louisiana. There's a funny story, Jim. There was a writer here in Washington who named Steve Hess, who was compiling a book that tried to rank different families in terms of their prominence in American political history. And when he did his first version, he had the Roosevelts first, the Kennedys second, and third were the Claibornes. And so Cokie reads the draft and says, Steve, you can just hear Cokie saying this, Steve, you left out six members of my family. And she forced him to redraft some rankings. So now the Claibornes are actually number two in all of American history in terms of the number of folks they've had in public life. The Roosevelts are ahead of us in the rankings, but only because they had two presidents. So the Claibornes, most of the Claibornes who served in public office were in the House of Representatives. Occasionally there was a senator like Senator Claiborne Pell of Rhode Island. But she always was very proud of her roots and connections to Louisiana.
As she should be. Now, I mentioned that your appearance is pertinent for any number of reasons, but One of them is that next month, the tragedy of Hale Boggs, who was killed in a plane crash, I think it was October 16th, 1972, 50 years ago, with another congressman, Nick Begich of Alaska. The wreckage of the plane was never found. Their bodies were never recovered. There is still some mystery as to what happened. And you were married to Cokie then. I think you were, what, you were in your 20s.
Yes.
Married young. And I'm sure that was just a horrible time. Cokie was with us on this show and talked about it at one point. And as usual, she was full of steel. But you could tell that all these years later, it affected her dramatically.
Well, absolutely right. We had been married at that point for 6 years. We were living in California. We had two small children. I was the New York Times correspondent in Los Angeles at the Times, and at the time, and when word started filtering out through news organizations that the plane was lost, my desk in New York called me, and I made a bad decision. I tried to get home from my office in downtown Los Angeles to our house to tell her personally, but of course we had so many friends who were in the news business that I walked in the house and she was standing there making dinner, just tears, you know, spilling down. And I realized immediately that she had already heard that he was lost. And the family, of course, as you say, it was uncertain for days. And Cokie and her family flew to Alaska. President Nixon at the time was enormously helpful and courteous, even though they were a Democratic family, and actually sent down a whole fleet of spy planes, U-2 spy planes, mm-hmm. which were based in Alaska. Of course, it was closest to American territory to Russia. And they rewrote the map of Alaska, but never found the plane. And most of us believe that it plunged into the very deep Prince William Sound and was never found again. But it, you're right, it did spawn today, to this day, a lot of mysteries. But as some of your listeners know, once it was, Hale did not appear to take his seat in January of 73. The seat was declared vacant. There was a special election. And Lindy, who had always been his closest advisor, and everybody knew that, they met as kids on the Hullabaloo, the Tulane student newspaper, as undergraduates. She was always his strongest advisor, and so she was virtually elected by acclamation. But there's a wonderful story where she calls her lifelong friend, Lady Bird Johnson, to tell her that she was planning to run for office. And she said, "Bird, I want you to know this from me before you read about the papers." And Mrs. Johnson says, "Why, Lindy, darling, that's wonderful news, but how are you going to do it without a wife?" And
Well, speaking of your column that appeared this week, over the last 31 years, writes Stephen Roberts, I've taught about 2,000 students at George Washington University. My classes have focused on politics and journalism, but many students maintain that the most lasting lesson they learned from me had nothing to do with the coursework. It is an adage I repeat often during after-class gatherings at off-campus watering holes. Who you marry is the most important decision you ever make in your life. Nothing else is even close. And I think sometimes we forget that.
Well, I'm glad you quoted that. Particularly after Cokie died, so many of my students repeated that to me and said, this is the most important thing we learned. And you know, Jim, I actually changed that adage slightly now. I don't say marriage anymore. I say partnership, because that's the core of it. It doesn't have to be legally sanctioned, and it certainly doesn't have to be a relationship between a man and a woman. It can be a same-sex relationship. It can be a non-binary relationship. You know, I'm trying to adapt to the times, but what remains eternally true is that human connection, that having a partnership with someone who supports you and loves you and stands by your side. I was so blessed. You know, I knew Cokie and I were married for 53 years. Most people don't get that much, and you always want more. But, I try to tell my students, looking back, and I've taught now for a long time, and I, looking back, this is by far the most important decision. And, I actually performed the wedding of a former student last weekend in Denver, Colorado, and I said that exact thing to them. You know, as I preached the marriage ceremony, I said, to this young couple, this is the most important decision you'll ever make. And at least on the evidence so far, you've made the right decision, the most important one. And you know, it's also true that so many of the students I teach are hungry for these role models, because a lot of their families have broken up. So many of my students come from homes where the parents have not stayed together, and they're hungry for encouragement. They're hungry for a model that says, you can do this. You can have an enduring partnership and a career and children. You know, the fact that Koki and I had 2 children and 6 grandchildren, none of whom are currently under indictment, was very encouraging to young people. And it really is by far, not even close, but by far the most important message. And this is true for Koki too. You know, this book that I've written about Koki, in some ways the most important lesson from her life was not her professional success. It was her personal mentorship and caring and support for young people, particularly young women, who, like my students, were so hungry for encouragement that they could have a meaningful partnership, a loving partnership, and children and a career, because that's what she had. So it wasn't just the lesson I teach, it was the lesson Koki taught as well.
Stephen Roberts, who will be with us Friday for the Founders Luncheon, and there is still an opportunity to attend. It's at the Crown Plaza, WRKF.org, if you would like more information. We've got time for a caller or two, but please be brief. Dan downtown. Dan, you're on with Stephen Roberts. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. Yes, in addition to a loss of relationships, as you say, is there also a loss in that congressmen are focusing during their terms of office on their future lobbying jobs rather than helping the constituents?
All right. What about congressmen becoming lobbyists? What's that done to our world?
Well, you know, I can argue this both ways. You know, members of Congress can be effective lobbyists because they have all these connections. But as Dan implies in the call, if members of Congress are calibrating their decisions as representatives to enhance their earning power down the road, that's a distortion. That's a corruption. While they're members of Congress, they should be thinking about their constituents and their welfare, the welfare of the city of Baton Rouge, the city of New Orleans, the state of Louisiana, not how they can maximize their income down the road. But I'm afraid that's not always the case, that some people have skewed values.
The book that Stephen referenced, Koki, A Life Well Lived, he will have some copies available for you on Friday. And it is an honor and pleasure to talk with Stephen Roberts, one of the best in his business. Thank you, sir, and see you Friday.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks, and we'll be back with Haley Campbell after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and Jerry Lane Chevrolet. Robin Dow producing. Your number is 877-217-5757. Fascinating writer Haley Campbell is with us. She's an author, broadcaster, journalist. Her work has appeared in Wired, The Guardian, and in many other places. And her book is All the Living and the Dead, From Embalmers to Executioners, An Exploration of the People Who Have Made Death Their Life's Work. And through the years in doing a show of this time, one of the topics people are most wary about is death. People do not want to talk about death, even though many of us are fascinated by it. Haley Campbell, you have gotten there, and it's a topic that's not for everybody, but as you note, we're surrounded by death. We can't get away from it. What do you think, Haley Campbell?
Hi. We are surrounded with it, but like you say, nobody wants to talk about it. I found that when I was trying to sell the book to publishers. They said death turns people off. They don't want to know about it. But when I was a kid, I was fascinated with death and the fact that people wouldn't answer my questions about it. And I don't think I was a strange kid. I was just a kid with questions, like all kids. But the fact that they wouldn't answer them kind of made it more interesting because it became secret. And I think as soon as you tell a kid that something is secret, or even give them the sense that it might be, you want to know all about it. And I've carried that with me right up until, you know, being an adult. And when I became a journalist, I realized I had a chance to go and ask all of those questions and find answers to things that I'd been thinking about my whole life. I don't understand how people can be alive in the world and not think about it. It's everywhere, and it's really interesting.
I once had a gentleman approach me about acquiring a funeral home, and he said, you know, I listened to you, and you're obviously interested in people's stories, and in no place do you find out more stories than you do at a funeral home. And I thought the guy had a point. And we do gather when people die, and we often note that they're better off somewhere else, and let's hope they are. But the reality is that we'll never see them again in this realm, and that is difficult for us to absorb, especially if they're a loved one. So that may explain why we're reluctant to delve into death, but it is the one constant in life. And you note that some people, like funeral homeowners, embalmers, executioners, they see it up close and personal, Haley.
They really do. And something I've found when I've been traveling around doing signings and talks for this book is that every person who comes up to me afterwards tells me something deep from their history, something about a person they loved who died. Maybe they were with that person, they were holding their hand. And it could be stories from 60 years ago or 2 years ago, but people, once you give them the opportunity to talk about it, they do want to talk about it. They do want to hear about it. It's just that they feel like they don't want to bring the mood down in daily life. And I found that with the people I spoke to for this book, all the people who are funeral directors and embalmers, they have learned over the years to not lie about their job, but say if somebody at the school gate said, what did you do for a living? The embalmer told me he says he's a teacher. He doesn't add that he's a teacher of embalming. He just says he's a teacher, because saying embalming kind of, it's a mood killer. either people will be, you know, morbidly, creepily interested in what he does, which he's uncomfortable with, or he will have upset them in some way. So even they found it really unusual that I wanted to talk to them. And to be honest, many of them were suspicious about it when I first met them. I had to go through so many layers of character reference to prove to them that I wasn't trying to do something, you know, salacious or bad, that I was genuinely interested in what they do, how they do it, and how they can do it every day without falling apart.
The book is All the Living and the Dead from an exceptional writer, Haley Campbell. One reviewer puts it this way: Campbell is a gorgeous writer, capturing the exquisite pathos and gallows humor found in folks who spend their lives working with the dead. Anyone who has ever considered death work will devour this book. Barry in Mid-City. Rabbi, you're on the air with Haley Campbell, a person who has seen his share of death. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, and good morning, Ms. Haley. I believe that the Jewish way of dying is really important and that folks would find it interesting. From our point of view, death is but a gateway to immortality and life after death, and I know that might seem strange, but I believe in the Jewish approach, which is that this day, this very day, is the first day of the rest of our life, and it's before death, and it's going to, from my point of view, it's going to be forever. Rabbi Abraham Heschel always wrote that eternity utters a day, so what we do and how we behave today affects the rest of our lives.
All right. Haley, would you like to respond to Rabbi Barry?
I find everybody's beliefs very interesting, and the fact that everybody has different ones. When I was growing up, I went to a Catholic school, and so whenever I had questions about death, I was told about heaven, and that didn't really answer my questions about... I was interested in the practicalities of what happened. So I never found that any religion I looked into really answered just the basic practical questions I had. But I do find it fascinating how each religion has they all have different beliefs around it, and nobody's got the same one. Death is so subjective, and we bring so much stuff to it.
We have a district attorney here in the community where this show originates, Baton Rouge, who goes to every death scene in our community. And I've talked to him minutes after he's been to one of those, and there is no evidence that he is affected by it. But yet last year, when a friend of ours was near death with COVID, he called me, and he was quite emotional. And it is amazing how people can compartmentalize their lives. Do you find this with people who obviously make their living in a way from death?
Yeah, absolutely. But I found that there was a difference between being desensitized. I think we think that people who have jobs that are horrific, like picking through the body parts after a plane crash or something, we think, well, they must be desensitized to the horror. I found that there's a difference between being desensitized and being detached. Because these people, it's not like they're not thinking about it. It's the opposite. They have thought about it. And they have detached themselves, but only enough that they can continue to do their jobs. And I found that the one person who claimed to be desensitized to it, who was the crime scene cleaner who I spoke to, he was the one who feared death the most. And I thought that was interesting. Everybody else who had seen it up close and kind of made some kind of peace with it and then stepped back just enough that they were able to still do their jobs didn't fear it in the way he did. And so I took that to mean that we need to look at it, but, you know, we then need to consider our own limits.
Well, it's quite a book, Kaylee. All the Living and the Dead, and you have told this in a delicate way, but certainly a compelling way. And we commend you for your work. And it may not be for everybody, but I think it's there's a message in here for everyone who wishes to read it. Thank you, Haley.
Thank you very much.
And we're joined in our home stretch by the remarkable Darlene Rowland, Darlene Adams Rowland, who's been with Bretta for 15 years, and that organization puts on the farmer's market. And for 2 years, she's been the executive director. And there's some major developments regarding this organization. Big River Economic Agricultural Development Alliance, right? There we go. So what's happening like right now? You're preparing as
yes,
we speak.
We have our big annual fundraising event, Farm Fete. It's tomorrow night, Thursday night, 6 to 9 p.m. at the downtown River Center Library Terrace. And you can find information at farmfete.org, farmfete.org. We've got 10 local restaurants serving food paired up with farmers, all fresh ingredients. Got some great cocktails by City Pork and silent and live auction, just a lot of great items that really reflect the community of the farmers.
People should just show up.
Well, tickets are available at farmfete.org. They're $100, but that includes all your food and drink. And so we would ask that you buy them in advance. We have a few left, not too many. So if you're interested, I would suggest you go on and grab those today.
Farmfete.org. And the farmers market's been around now for how long?
26 years this November, and, you know, we're coming into fall, really our high season of the fall harvest, and that's when we open up our Tuesday market, which will return this Tuesday at the main library from 3 to 6 p.m.
Goodwood
Library, yes. So we got two libraries covered here. We got Farm Fete at the downtown one tomorrow, and on Tuesday at the main Goodwood Library.
As in next Tuesday,
yeah,
six days away, October 4th.
Lots going on.
Buddy Romer's birthday. There will be a celebration at the main library at Goodwood, and it's the Farmer's Market. And we thank you, commend you for what you do. And again, farmfete.org, correct?
Correct.
All right. Well, Darlene Adams Rowland does her thing exceptionally well. It's always a pleasure to catch up with her, even if it's a short visit. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting and Jerry Lane. Stay safe and stay tuned.